This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Without responding, she wriggled her hand back into the alcove. It seemed like she was trying to twist something, but it must not have budged, as a second later she sat back and huffed with frustration. "I can see that you're in need of an accomplice," Thorne said, straightening his jumpsuit. "And lucky for you, I happen to be a criminal mastermind." She glowered at him. "Go away." "That's a difficult request in this situation." She sighed and dusted the flecks of white plastic from her screwdriver. "What are you going to do when you get out?" he asked. She turned back to the wall. The grinding persisted for a while before she paused to roll her neck, working at a crick. "The most direct route out of the city is north." "Oh, my naive little convict, don't you think that's what they'll be expecting you to do?" She dragged the screwdriver into the alcove. "Would you please stop distracting me? I'm just saying we might be able to help each other." "Leave me alone. I have a ship." Her gaze started to him for only a beat, a look of warning. "A spaceship." "A spaceship?" she drawled. "She could have us halfway to the stars in less than 2 minutes, and she's just outside the city limits. Easy to get to. What do you say?" "I say if you don't stop talking and let me work, we won't be getting halfway to anywhere." "Point taken," Thorne said, holding up his hands in surrender. "You just think it over in that pretty little head of yours." She tensed but kept working. "Now that I'm thinking of it, there used to be an excellent dim sum bar just a block away, too. They had mini pork buns that were to die for, rich and succulent." He pinched his fingers together, salivating over the memory. Face scrunching up, Cinder started to massage the back of her neck. "Maybe if we have time, we could stop in and pick up a snack for the road. I could use a treat after suffering through the tasteless junk they call food in this place." He licked his lips, but when he refocused on the girl, the pain on her features had tightened. Sweat was beading on her brow. "Are you all right?" he asked, reaching for her. "Do you need a back rub?" She swatted him away. "Please," she said, hands braced between them. She struggled to draw in a shuddering breath. As Thorne stared, her image wavered like heat rising off maglev tracks. He stumbled back. His heartbeat quickened. A tingle filled his brain and raced down his nerves. She was beautiful. No, divine. No, perfect. His pulse thumped, thoughts of worship and devotion swimming through his head, thoughts of surrender, thoughts of compliance. "Please," she said again, hiding behind her metal hand. Her tone was desperate as she slumped against the wall. "Just stop talking. Just leave me alone." "All right." Confusion reigned. Cyborg, prison mate, goddess. "Of course, anything you like." Eyes watering, he stumbled backward and sank blindly down to his cot. Chapter 5. Scarlet's thoughts seethed as she hauled the empty crates out of the back of her ship and through the hangar's yawning doors. She'd found her port screen on the floor of the ship, and it was now in her pocket, the message from law enforcement office burning against her thigh as she mindlessly traipsed through her evening routine. She was perhaps most angry at herself now for being distracted, even for a minute, by nothing more than a handsome face and a veneer of danger, so soon after she'd learned that her grandma's case had been closed. Her curiosity about the street fighter made her feel like a traitor to everything important. And then there was Roland and Gilles and every other backstabber in Rieu. They all believed her grandma was crazy, and that's what they told the police. Not that she was the most hard-working farmer in the province, not that she made the best eclairs this side of the Garonne River, not that she served her country as a military spaceship pilot for 28 years and still wore a Medal of Honorable Service on her favored checkered kitchen apron. No, They told the police she was crazy. And now they stopped looking for her. Not for long, though. Her grandma was out there somewhere, and Scarlett was going to find her if she had to dig up dirt and blackmail every last detective in Europe. The sun was sinking fast, sending Scarlett's elongated shadow down the drive. Beyond the gravel, the whispering crops of cornstalks and leafy sugar beets stretched out in every direction, meeting up with the first spray of stars. A cobblestone house disrupted the view to the west, with two windows glowing orange, their only neighbor for miles. For more than half her life, this farm had been Scarlett's paradise. Over the years, she'd fallen in love with it more deeply than she'd known a person could fall in love with land and sky, and she knew her grandma felt the same. Though she didn't like to think of it, she was aware that someday she would inherit the farm, and she sometimes fantasized about growing old here, happy and content with perpetual dirt beneath her fingernails and an old house that was in constant need of repair. Happy and content, like her grandmother. She wouldn't have just left. Scarlett knew it. She lugged the crates into the barn, stacking them in the corner so the androids could fill them again tomorrow, then grabbed the pail of chicken feed. Scarlett walked while she fed, tossing big handfuls of kitchen scraps in her path as the chickens scurried around her ankles. Rounding the corner of the hangar, she halted. A light was on in the house, on the second floor, in her grandmother's bedroom. The pail slipped from her fingers. The chickens squawked and darted away before clustering back around the spilled feed. She stepped over them and ran, the gravel skidding beneath her shoes. Her heart was swelling, bursting, the sprint already making her lungs burn as she yanked open the back door. She took the stairs two at a time, the old wood groaning beneath her. The door to her grandma's bedroom was open, and she froze in the doorway, panting, grasping the jamb. A hurricane had come through the room. Every drawer was pulled out from the dresser. Clothes and toiletries had been dumped onto the floor. The quilts from the bed were piled haphazardly at its foot, the mattress at an angle, the digital picture frames beside the window all pulled from their brackets, leaving dark spots on the wall where the sunlight hadn't managed to fade the painted plaster. A man was on his knees beside the bed, tearing through a box of her grandmother's old military uniforms. He jumped up when he saw Scarlett, nearly hitting his head on the low oak beam that spanned the ceiling. The world spun. Scarlett almost didn't recognize him. It had been years since she'd seen him, but it could have been decades for how much he'd had aged. A beard was taking over his normally clean-shaven jaw. His hair was matted on one side, sticking up straight on the other. He was pale and gaunt, like he hadn't had a proper meal in weeks. "Dad?" He clutched a blue flight jacket to his chest. "What are you doing here?" She surveyed the chaos again, heart still pounding. "What are you doing?" "There's something here," he said, his voice rough and unused. "She's hidden something." He peered down at the jacket, then tossed it onto the bed. Kneeling, he started digging through the box again. "I need to find it."
"Find what? What are you talking about?"
"She's gone," he whispered. "She's not coming back. She won't ever know, and I have to find it. I have to know why." The smell of cognac swirled through the air, and Scarlett's heart hardened. She didn't know how he'd found out about his mother's disappearance, but for him to just assume all hope was lost so easily, so quickly, and to think he would be entitled to a single thing that had belonged to her after he'd abandoned them both. To go so many years without a single calm, only to show up drunk and start tearing through her grandmother's things. Scarlett had a sudden urge to call the police, except she was mad at them, too. "Get out! Get out of our house!" Unfazed, he started to pile the mishmash of clothes back into the box. Face burning, Scarlet rounded the bed and grabbed his arm, trying to yank him to his feet.
"Stop it!"
he hissed and fell back onto the old wooden floorboards. He scurried away from her as he would from a rabid dog, clutching his arm. His gaze was stark madness. Scarlet drew back, surprised, before planting clenched fists on her hips.
"What's wrong with your arm?"
He didn't answer, just kept nursing the arm against his chest. Setting her jaw, Scarlet stomped toward him and grabbed his wrist. He yelped and tried to pull away, but she held firm, shoving his sleeve up to his elbow. Scarlet gasped and let go, but the arm continued to hang in midair, like he'd forgotten to retract it. The skin was covered in burn marks, each one a perfect circle and placed in a neat, perfect row, row upon row upon row, circling his forearm from wrist to elbow, some shining with wrinkled scar tissue, others blackened and glistening, and on his wrist a scab where his ID chip had once been implanted. Her stomach turned. Back against the wall, her father buried his face in the mattress, away from Scarlet, away from the burns.
"Who did this to you?"
His arm fell, curling against his stomach. He said nothing. Scarlet pushed herself off the wall and ran to the bathroom in the hallway. She returned a moment later with a tube of ointment and a roll of bandages. Her father hadn't moved.
"They made me,"
he whispered, his hysteria fading. Scarlet eased his arm away from his stomach and began to dress the wound as tenderly as she could, despite her shaking hands.
"Who made you do what?"
"I couldn't get away," he continued as if he hadn't heard her. "They asked so many questions, and I didn't know. I didn't know what they wanted. I tried to answer them, but I didn't know." Scarlet glanced up from her work as her father tilted his head toward her and stared blankly across the tasseled blankets. Tears had pooled in his eyes. Her father, crying. It was almost more shocking than the burns. Her chest clamped and she froze, the bandage wrapped halfway up his forearm. She realized that she did not know this sad, broken man. This was only a shell of her father, her charismatic and selfish and worthless father. Where anger and hatred had flared before, there was now an aching sense of pity. What possibly could have caused this? "They gave me the poker," he continued, his eyes wide in distance.
"They gave you? Why?"
"And they brought me to her, and I realized she was the one with the answers. She was the one with the information. They wanted something from her, but she just watched. She just watched me do it. And she cried, but they asked her the same questions, and she still wouldn't answer them. She wouldn't answer them." His voice hiccuped, his face flushing with sudden anger. "She let them do this to me." Struggling to gulp, Scarlet finished off the wrapping and leaned against the mattress, her legs beginning to tremble.
"Grandmère, you saw her?"
His attention flashed back to her, crazed again.
"They had me for a week, and then they just let me go. They could tell she didn't care about me. She wouldn't give in for me."
Without warning, he pushed forward and clambered toward Scarlet on his knees, grasping her arms. She tried to shrink away, but he held her firm, his fingernails digging into her skin.
"What is it, Scar? What's so important, more important than her own son? Dad, you have to calm down. You have to tell me where she is,"
her thoughts stammered.
"Where is she? Who has her? Why?"
Her father's eyes searched her, panicked and shimmering. Slowly he shook his head and dropped his attention to the floor.
"She's hiding something," he mumbled. "I want to know what it is. What is she hiding, Scar? Where is it?"
He turned to rustle through a drawer of old cotton shirts that had clearly already been rifled through. He was sweating now, his hair damp around his ears. Scarlet used the bed frame to hoist herself onto the mattress.
"Dad, please,"
She tried to sound soothing, though her heart was thumping so hard it hurt.
Where is she?
Don't know. He dug his fingernails into the space between the molding and the wall. I was at a bar in Paris. They must have drugged my drink, because next I woke up in a dark room. It smelled damp, musty, he sniffed. They drugged me when they let me go, too. One minute I was in that dark room. Then I was here. I woke up in the cornfield. With a shudder, Scarlet pulled her hands through her hair until the curls knotted around them. They brought him here, to the same place they kidnapped her grandmother. Why? Did these people know that Scarlet was his only family? Did they think she would be the best person to take care of him? That didn't make any sense. Clearly, they weren't worried about her dad's well-being. So what else? Was leaving him here a message to her? A threat? You must remember something, she said, her voice taking on a tinge of desperation. Something about the room, or something someone said. Did you get a good look at them? Could you describe one of them to a profiler? Anything?
Was drugged, he said quickly, but then his brow drew together as he struggled to think.
He made to touch his burn marks, but then let his hand fall into his lap. Wouldn't let me see them. Scarlet barely resisted the urge to shake him and scream that he had to think harder. Did they blindfold you?
No,
he squinted. I was afraid to look. Frustrated tears were beginning to sting her eyes, and Scarlet tilted her head back, gulping down patient breaths. Her worst fears, those sneaking, horrible suspicions, were true. Her grandmother had been kidnapped. Not just kidnapped, but kidnapped by cruel, brutal people. Were they harming her as they'd harm her son? What would they do to her? What did they want? Ransom? But why hadn't they asked Scarlet for anything yet? And why had they taken her father, too, but then let him go? It didn't make sense. Terror clouded her thoughts as all possible horrors streamed through her imagination. Torture and burning and dark rooms. What do you mean when they said they made you? What did they make you do?
Burn myself, he whispered.
Handed me the poker.
But how?
So many questions. I don't know. I never knew my father. She doesn't talk about him. I don't know what she does here in her big ancient house. What happened on the moon? Don't know what she's hiding. She's hiding something.
He pulled weakly at the blankets on the bed, glancing half-heartedly beneath the sheets.
You're talking nonsense, Scarlet said, her voice breaking. You have to think harder. You have to remember something.
A long, long silence. Outside, the chickens were clucking again, their scaly feet scratching across the gravel.
Tattoo.
She frowned.
What?
He placed a finger over one of the burns on the inside flesh of his arm, just below his elbow. The one who handed me the poker had a tattoo. Here, letters and numbers. Her vision prickled with bright lights, and Scarlet gripped the rumpled quilt, for a moment feeling like she could faint. Letters and numbers.
Are you sure? L.S.?
He shook his head. I can't remember. There was more. Her mouth ran dry, hatred overtaking the dizziness. She knew that tattoo. He'd pretended to be kind, pretended he'd only needed honest work. When, days, hours before, he tortured her father, kept her grandmother prisoner, and she'd almost trusted him, the tomato, the carrots. She thought she was helping him. Stars above, she'd flirted with him, and all the while he knew. She recalled those moments of peculiar amusement, the glint in his eyes, and her stomach twisted. He'd been laughing at her. Ears ringing, she peered down at her dad, who was turning out the pockets of a pair of pants that probably hadn't fit her grandmother in 20 years. She stood. The blood rushed to her head, but she ignored it. Marching to the corner of the room, she grabbed her grandma's port screen from where her father had tossed it onto the floorboards. Here, she said, throwing the port onto the bed. I'm going to the Morrell farm. If I'm not home in 3 hours, calm the police.
Dazed, her father reached out and grasped the port. I thought the Morrells were dead. Are you listening to me? I want you to lock all the doors and don't leave. 3 hours and then calm the police. Do you understand?
Again, he succumbed to that frightened, childlike expression. Don't go out there, Scar. Don't you get it? They used me as bait for her, and you'll be next. They'll come for you, too.
Clenching her jaw, Scarlet zipped up her hoodie to her chin. I intend to find them first.
Chapter 6. Carswell Farm. ID number 00826-88359. Born 22nd May, 106 TE. American Republic. FF437 Media Hits. Reverse Cron. Posted 12 January 126 TE. Exed AR Air Force Cadet Carswell Thorne has been convicted and sentenced to a 6-year prison sentence at the end of a speedy 2-week trial. Green text trekked across Cinder's vision, documenting the crimes of one Carswell Thorne, who had already led a very productive life of lawbreaking despite having just turned 20 a few months ago. 1 count military desertion, 2 counts international theft, 1 count attempted theft, 6 counts handling of stolen goods, and 1 count theft of government property. That last conviction hardly seemed to do the crime justice. He'd stolen a spaceship from the American Republic's military, hence the spaceship that he was so proud of. Though he was currently serving a 6-year sentence in the Eastern Commonwealth for attempted theft of a second-era jade necklace, he was also wanted in Australia and, of course, his own America, and would be standing trial and no doubt serving time in both countries for the harm he'd done there as well. Cinder slumped against a breaker panel, wishing she hadn't checked. Escaping from prison herself was bad enough, but assisting the escape of this criminal, a real criminal, and doing it in a stolen spaceship? Swallowing hard, she peered back through the opening she'd made between the mechanical room and the prisoner's cell. Carswell Thorne still sat on his cot, with his elbows propped on his knees, thumbs twiddling. She wiped her damp palm on her bleached white jumper. This was not about Carswell Thorne. This was about Queen Lavanna and Emperor Kai and Princess Selene, the innocent child Lavanna had tried to murder 13 years ago, but who had been rescued and smuggled down to Earth, who remained the most wanted person in the world, who just happened to be Cinder herself. She'd known for less than 24 hours. Dr. Erlin, who had known for weeks, decided to inform her that he'd run DNA tests proving her bloodline only after Queen Lavanna had recognized her at the annual ball and threatened to attack Earth if Cinder wasn't thrown into jail for being an illegal lunar emigrant. So Dr. Erlin had sneaked into her prison cell and given her a new foot. Hers had fallen off on the palace steps. A state-of-the-art cyborg hand with fancy gadgets that she was still getting used to, and the biggest shock of her life. He'd then told her to escape and come meet him in Africa. Like that would be no more difficult than installing a new processor on a Guard 3.9. This order, simultaneously so simple and so impossible, had given her something to focus on other than her newfound identity. Good thing, too, because when she dwelled on that, her entire body had a tendency to seize up, leaving her useless, and this was a bad time to be suffering from indecision. Regardless of what she would do when she got out, she was sure of one thing.
Not escaping meant certain death when Queen Lavanna came to claim her. She peered back at the inmate again. If she had a close destination in mind, and a working spaceship at that, it could be the key to her escape. He was still twiddling his thumbs, still obeying her command, "Just leave me alone." The words had been fire in her mouth when she said them, while her blood had boiled and her skin had burned. The sensation of overheating was a side effect of her new lunar gift, powers that Dr. Erlin had managed to unlock after a device implanted on her spine had kept her from using them for so many years. Although it still seemed like magic to her, it was really a genetic trait lunars were born with that allowed them to control and manipulate the bioelectricity of other living creatures. They could trick people into seeing things that weren't real or experiencing made-up emotions. They could brainwash people into doing things they wouldn't otherwise do, without argument, without resistance. Cinder was still learning how to use this gift, and she wasn't entirely sure how she managed to control Carswell Thorne, just as she wasn't sure how she managed to persuade one of the jail guards to move her to a more convenient cell. All she knew was that she'd wanted to strangle this inmate when he wouldn't stop talking, and her lunar gift had surged at the base of her neck, spurred on by stress and nerves. She'd lost control of it for a moment, and in that breath, Thorne had done precisely what she'd wanted him to do. He'd stopped talking and left her alone. Her guilt had been instantaneous. She didn't know what kind of effect it had on a person, all that brain manipulation. And more than that, she didn't want to be one of those lunars who took advantage of her powers just because she could. She didn't want to be lunar at all. She huffed, blowing a strand of hair away from her face and ducked through the hole that had been created when she'd pried the urinal out of the wall. He looked up as she came to a halt before him, arms akimbo. He was still dazed, and though she hated to admit it, he was actually rather attractive. If a girl happened to like that square jaw, bright blue eyes, devilish dimples kind of a thing, although he was in desperate need of a haircut and a good shave. She took in a stabilizing breath. "I forced you to do what I wanted you to do, and I shouldn't have. It was an abuse of power, and I'm sorry." He blinked down at her metal hand and the screwdriver sticking out from one finger joint. "Are you the same girl who was just here?" he asked, his voice surprisingly clear, even with his heavy American accent. For some reason, she expected him to slur his words after the brain manipulation. "Of course I am." "Oh," his brow furrowed, "you seemed a lot prettier before." Bristling, Cinder considered retracting her apology, but instead crossed her arms over her chest. "Cadet Thorne, was it?"
"Captain Thorne. Your records say you were a cadet when you deserted."
He frowned, still puzzled, before he brightened and cocked a finger toward her. "Port screen in the head?" She bit the inside of her cheek. "Well, if you wanted to be technical about it," he said. "But I'm a captain now. I prefer the sound of it. Girls are much more impressed." Cinder, unimpressed, gestured toward the mechanical room on the other side of the wall. "I've decided you can come with me if we can make it to your ship. Just try not to talk too much." He was off his cot before she finished speaking. "It was my irresistible charm that convinced you, wasn't it?" Sighing, she retreated through the hole, careful to step over the disconnected plumbing. "So this ship of yours, it is the stolen one, right? From the American military?" "I don't like to think of it as stolen. They have no proof that I didn't plan on giving it back." "You're kidding, right?" He shrugged. "You have no proof either." She squinted back at him. Were you planning on giving it back?
Maybe.
An orange light blinked on in the corner of Cinder's vision, her cyborg programming picking up on the lie.
That's what I thought, she muttered.
Is the ship traceable?
Of course not.
Removed all the tracking equipment ages ago.
Good.
Which reminds me. Holding up her hand, she retracted the screwdriver and, after two attempts, released the stiletto knife. We need to remove your ID chip.
He drew half a step back.
Don't tell me you're squeamish.
Of course not, he said with an uncomfortable laugh, cuffing his left sleeve.
It's just, is that thing sterilized?
Cinder glowered.
I mean, I'm sure you're very hygienic and all. It's just...
He trailed off, hesitated, then held his hand out toward her.
Never mind. Just try not to hit anything important.
Bending over his arm, Cinder angled the blade to his wrist as carefully and gently as she could. There was a faint scar there already, presumably from when he'd cut out another ID chip when he'd first been on the run from law enforcement. His fingers twitched at the invasion, but otherwise he was still as a stone. She extracted the bloodied ID chip and tossed it into a bundle of cords on the floor before cutting a strip of cloth from his sleeve and letting him wrap it around the wound.
Is it just me, or is this a big moment in our relationship?
Cinder scoffed. Turning away, she pointed at the grate near the ceiling. It was surrounded by tethered wires that snaked out from the breaker panel and disappeared into dozens of holes along the walls.
Can you boost me up there?
What is it?
Thorne asked, already lacing his fingers together.
Air duct.
Cinder stepped into his palms and ignored his grunt as he lifted her. She'd expected it, knowing that her metal leg made her a lot heavier than she looked. With the added leverage, she had the grate removed in seconds. She set it quietly atop some overhead plumbing pipes and then pulled herself into the opening without hesitation. She called up the blueprint of the jail's interior structure to check the direction while she waited for Thorne to clamber up behind her. Switching on her built-in flashlight, Cinder started to crawl. It was hot and clumsy work, with her left leg scraping against the aluminum every few inches. Twice she stopped to listen, thinking she heard footsteps somewhere below. Would there be an alarm when their escape was discovered? She was surprised there hadn't been one yet. 32 minutes. She left her cell 32 minutes ago. The sweat dripping off her nose and the rapidness of her heartbeat made the time stretch on, as if the clock in her head had gotten stuck. Thorne's presence was already filling her with doubts. This was going to be hard enough with just her. How was she going to sneak both of them out? The thought passed through her skull, startling and clear. She could brainwash him. She could convince him that he wanted to tell her where the ship was and how to get it. And then she could make him decide that he didn't want to come with her after all. She could send him back. He would have no choice but to listen to her.
Everything all right?
Cinder released the air that had stuck in her throat.
No.
She wouldn't take advantage of him or anyone. She'd gotten on just fine without any lunar gift before. She would get on just fine now.
Sorry, she muttered. Just checking the blueprint. We're almost there.
Blueprint? She ignored him. Minutes later, she rounded a corner and saw a square of checkered light on the duct's ceiling. A tinge of relief, of hope, fluttered inside her as she inched her head out over the grate and peered down. She saw an expanse of concrete with a small puddle of standing water beneath her, and, not six steps from that, another grate, this one larger and round, a storm drain, right where the blueprint said it would be. The drop was a full story, but if they could make it without breaking any legs, this was almost going to be easy.
"Where are we?"
Thorn whispered.
"Underground loading dock, where they bring in food and supplies."
As gracefully as she could, she climbed over the grate and maneuvered back around so that she and Thorn could both peer through the grid.
"We need to get down there to that storm drain." Thorn frowned and pointed.
"Isn't that the exit ramp over there?"
She nodded without looking.
"Why aren't we trying to get there?"
She peered up at him, the grate casting peculiar shadows across his face.
"And just walk to your spaceship in bright white prison uniforms?"
He frowned, but any response was silenced by the sound of voices. They ducked back.
"I didn't see him dancing with her. My sister did," said a woman. Her words were coupled with footsteps, then a rolling door being hoisted up on clunky rails. Her dress was soaking wet and wrinkled as a garbage bag.
"But why would the Emperor dance with a cyborg?" said a man. "And then for her to go off and attack the Lunar Queen like that? No way. Your sister was seeing things. I bet the girl was just some crazy person who wandered in off the streets. She was probably bitter over some cyborg injustice."
The conversation was cut short by the rumbling of a delivery ship. Cinder dared to peer through the gate again and saw a ship wheeling its way beneath them, backing up toward a recessed loading bay and stopping directly between Cinder and Thorn and the storm drain.
"Morning, Ryujun," said the man as the pilot descended from the ship. The rest of their greeting were drowned out by the hydraulics hissing on an adjustable platform. Taking advantage of the noise, Cinder used her screwdriver to remove the grate. When she gave Thorn a nod, he carefully eased it up. Sweat trickled down Cinder's neck, and her heart was palpitating so hard she thought it might bruise the inside of her rib cage. Lowering her head, she peered around the dock, checking for any other signs of life, and spotted, not arm's distance away on the concrete ceiling, a rotating camera. She jerked back inside, pulse hissing in her ears. Luckily, the camera had been facing the other direction, but still, there was no way they could both make it down undetected. Then there were the three workers unloading the delivery to deal with, and every moment gone was one more moment toward some guard discovering their empty cells. She shut her eyes, imagining where the camera was, before snaking her arm out. Her hand floundered, flat against the ceiling. The camera was farther than it had seemed in that momentary glance, but then her fingers found it. She grasped the lens and squeezed. The plastic was crushed as easily as a plum in her titanium fist, making a satisfying crunching sound that seemed definitely loud. She listened, relieved as the same sounds of shuffling and chatting continued below. Their time was up. It wouldn't be more than a minute now before someone realized a camera had been disabled. Raising her head, she nodded at Thorn and pulled herself forward over the opening. She dropped onto the roof of the delivery ship, and it clanged and shuddered beneath her. Thorn followed, landing with a muffled grunt. The talking silenced. Cinder spun around as three figures emerged from the loading bay, their faces contorted in confusion. They spotted her and Thorn standing atop the ship and froze. Cinder could see them taking in the white uniforms, her cyborg hand. One of the men reached for the port screen on his belt. Clenching her jaw, Cinder held her hand out to him, thinking only of how he could not get to his port, could not send out an alarm, thinking of his hand petrified in space just centimeters from his belt. At her will, his hand stalled and hung motionless, his eyes filled with terror. "Don't move," said Cinder,
her voice hoarse, guilt already clawing at her throat. She knew she was every bit as panicked as the three people standing before her, and yet the fear on their faces was unmistakable. The burning sensation returned, starting at the top of her neck and spreading down through her spine, her shoulders and hips stinging where it met her prosthesis. It wasn't painful or sudden, like it had been when Dr. Erlin had first unlocked her lunar gift. Rather, it was almost comforting, almost pleasant. She could sense the three people standing on the platform, the bioelectricity rolling off them in waves, crackling in the air, ready to be controlled. Turn around. In unison, the three workers turned around, their bodies stiff and awkward. Close your eyes. Cover your ears. She hesitated before adding, hum. Instantly, the buzz of three people humming filled what had become a silent delivery dock. She hoped it would be enough to keep them from hearing the grate open in the concrete floor. Her only hope was that they would assume she and Thorne had left through the dock exit or smuggled themselves aboard a delivery ship. Thorne was staring, slack-jawed, when Cinder turned back to him. What are they doing? Obeying, she said heavily, hating herself for making the command, hating the hums that filled her ears, hating this gift that was too unnatural, too powerful, too unfair. But the thought to release her control over them never crossed her mind. Come on, she said, half jumping, half sliding off the ship. She crawled beneath it and found the grate between the landing wheels. Though her hands were shaking, she managed to twist the grate a quarter turn and pull it up. A shallow pool of standing water glistened up at her in the darkness. The fall wasn't far, but her bare feet landing in the oily water made her queasy. Thorne was beside her in a second, replacing the grate over the hole. There was a round concrete tunnel set into the wall, barely reaching Cinder's stomach and filled with the stench of garbage and mildew. Wrinkling her nose, Cinder crouched and crawled into it. Chapter 7. The cluster of icons on Emperor Kai's net screen was growing denser by the hour. Not only because there were so many things for the new emperor to read and sign, but because he wasn't putting much effort into reading or signing any of them. With fingers buried in his hair, he gazed blankly at the inset net screen panel currently elevated out of his desk and watched the icons multiply with a growing sense of dread. He should have been sleeping, but after countless hours of staring at the shadows above his bed, he'd finally given up and decided to come here instead and attempt to do something productive. He was dying for a distraction, any distraction, anything to chase away the thoughts that kept rotating around in his brain. So much for those good intentions. Taking in a measured breath, Kai glanced up at the empty office. It was supposed to be his father's office, but the room struck Kai as far too extravagant to be a place for work. Three ornate tasseled lanterns were lined up on a red and gold ceiling, hand-painted with elegant dragons. A holographic fireplace was set into the wall to his left. A sitting area with carved cypress furniture surrounded a miniature bar in the far corner. Silent videos of Kai's mother shimmered from picture frames by the door, sometimes paired with flashes of Kai growing up and sometimes all three of them together. Nothing had changed since his father's death, except the room's owner. And perhaps the smell. Kai seemed to recall the aroma of his father's aftershave, but now there was the distinct stench of bleach and chemicals, remnants of the cleaning crew scrubbing the room raw after his father first had contracted leptomosis, the plague that had killed hundreds of thousands of people all over Earth in the past decade. Kai's attention fell from the pictures and snagged on the small metal foot that sat on the corner of his desk, its joints caked with grease. Like a revolving wheel, his thoughts came full circle yet again. Lynn Cinder. Stomach tightening, he set down the stylus that he'd been gripping and reached for the foot, but his fingers stalled before they could get to it. It belonged to her, the pretty young mechanic at the market, the girl who was so easy to talk to, the girl who was so authentic, who didn't pretend to be something she wasn't. Or so he'd thought. His fingers tightened into a fist, and he drew back, wishing he had someone he could talk to. But his father was gone, and now Dr. Erlin was gone too, having resigned from his position and left without even saying goodbye. There was Con Torin, his father's and now his advisor, but Torin, with his ever-present diplomacy and logic, would never understand. Kai wasn't sure he even understood what it was he felt when he thought of Cinder, Lynn Cinder, who had lied to him about everything. She was Cyborg. He couldn't dismiss the memory of her lying at the base of the garden steps, a foot disconnected from her leg, a white-hot metal hand having melted away the remnants of a silk glove, gloves that had been his gift to her. He should have been repulsed by her. Reliving the memory again and again, he tried to be repulsed by the sparking wires and her grime-packed knuckles and the knowledge that she had fake neural receptors taking messages to and from her brain. She was not natural. She was probably a charity case, and he couldn't help but wonder if her family had paid for the operation or if it had been government-funded. He wondered who had taken such pity on her that they determined to give her a second life when her human body had been so damaged. He wondered what had caused her body to be that damaged in the first place, or if perhaps she was born disfigured. He wondered and wondered, and knew he should have been more disturbed by each unanswered question, but he wasn't. It was not her being Cyborg that had curdled her stomach. Rather, his repugnance had started the moment his vision of her flickered as if she were a broken net screen. He'd blinked, and she was no longer a helpless, rain-soaked cyborg, but the most intensely beautiful girl he'd ever laid eyes on. She was blindingly, breathtakingly stunning, with flawless tan skin and shining eyes, and an expression so ravishing it threatened to buckle his knees. Her lunar glamour had been even more striking than Queen Lavanna's, and her beauty was painful. Kai knew that's what it had been, Cinder's glamour, fading in and out, even as he stood above her, trying to make sense of what he was seeing. What he didn't know was how many times she'd glamoured him before, how many times she tricked him, how many times she made him out to be a complete fool. Or had the girl at the market, muddied and disheveled, been the real girl after all? The girl who had risked her life to come to the ball to give Kai a warning, unsteady cyborg foot and all. "It doesn't matter," he said to his empty office. The disconnected foot. Whoever Lynn Cinder was, she was no longer his concern. Soon Queen Lavanna would be returning to Luna, and she would take Cinder back as her prisoner. It was the arrangement Kai had agreed to. At the ball, he'd been forced to make a choice and had refused Lavanna's offer of a marriage alliance once and for all. He was determined to never subject his people to life beneath such a heartless empress, and by that point Cinder had been his last bargaining chip. Peace in exchange for the cyborg, his people's freedom in exchange for the lunar girl who had dared to defy her queen. it was impossible to know how long such an arrangement would last. Lavanna still refused to sign the peace treaty that would ally Luna with the Earth in Union. Her desire to be either empress or conqueror would not be sated long by the sacrifice of a mere girl. And next time, Kai didn't think he would have anything else to offer. Crumpling his hair, Kai pulled his attention back to the amendment on the net screen and read the first sentence three times, waiting for the words to register. He had to think of something else, anything else, before the never-ending questions drove him insane. A monotone voice interrupted him, making him jump. Entrance requested for Royal Advisor Khan Torin and Chairman of National Security Wei Dishao. Kai glanced at the time, 06:22. Entrance granted. The office door breezed open. Both men were dressed for the day, though Kai had never seen either of them so disheveled. It was clear they'd gotten up in a hurry, although he suspected from the dark circles beneath Torin's eyes that he hadn't gotten much more sleep than Kai had. Kai stood to greet them, tapping the corner of the net screen that sent it sinking back into the desktop. "You're both getting an early start." "Your Imperial Majesty," said Chairman Wei with a deep bow, "I'm glad to find you awake. I'm sorry to inform you of a breach of security that requires your immediate attention." Kai froze, his thoughts racing ahead to terrorist attacks, out-of-control protesters, Queen Lavanna declaring war. "What? What happened?" "There's been a jailbreak from New Beijing prison," said Wei, "approximately 48 minutes ago." Nerves knotting up his shoulders, Kai glanced at Torin. "A jailbreak?" "Two inmates have escaped." Kai pushed his fingertips into the desk. "Don't we have some sort of protocol in place for this?" "Generally speaking, yes. However, this is an extraordinary circumstance." "How so?" The lines deepened around Wei's mouth. "One of the escapees is Lin Cinder, Your Majesty, the lunar fugitive." The world turned over. Kai's gaze dropped to the cyborg foot, but he snapped it back up. "How?" "We have a team analyzing the security footage in order to determine her exact method. We understand she was able to glamour a guard and persuade him to move her to a separate wing of the prison. From there, she was able to breach the air duct system." Suddenly embarrassed, Wei held up two clear bags. One contained a cyborg hand, the other a small blood-crusted chip. "These were found in her cell." Kai's jaw worked, but he was dumbfounded by the sight. He was simultaneously intrigued and unnerved by the dismembered limb. "Is that her hand? Why would she do that?" "We're still working on the details. We do know, however, that she made her way into the prison's loading dock. We are working to secure all possible escape routes from there." Kai paced toward the floor-to-ceiling windows that overlooked the palace's west-facing gardens. The whispering grasses still glittered with morning dew. "Your Majesty," said Torin, the first he'd spoken, "I would advise you to deploy military reinforcements to track down and recover the fugitives." Kai massaged his brow. "Military?" Torin spoke slowly. "It is in your best interest to do everything in your power to recover her." Kai found it difficult to swallow. He knew that Torin was right. Any hesitation would be seen as a sign of weakness and possibly even suggest that he'd assisted with the escape. Queen Lavanna would not take kindly to it. "Who's the other fugitive?" he asked, stalling for time while he struggled to grasp the implications. "Cinder, a lunar, a cyborg, a fugitive who'd all but sentenced to death." Escaped. Carswell Thorne, said Way, an ex-cadet for the American Republic Air Force. He deserted his post 14 months ago after stealing a military cargo ship. At this time, we don't consider him dangerous. Kai neared his desk again, seeing that the fugitive's profile had been transferred to the screen. His frown deepened. Perhaps not dangerous, but young and inarguably good-looking. His prison photo showed him flippantly winking at the camera. Kai hated him immediately. "Your Majesty, we need to make a decision," said Torin. "Do you grant permission to send in military reinforcements to secure the fugitive?" Kai stiffened. "Yes, of course, if that's what you think the situation requires."